Accession number 32720, Reel 1.
Graduated from Fenwick High School in 1941. He applied for pilot training. They gave him all kinds of problems, including the fact that he's not qualified educationally and needed 2 years of college. A lot of you went through that. And he finally got around that. He got into training, became a fighter pilot. He graduated in the class of 44A, January 1944. And he went overseas with the 8th Air Force. He flew two combat tours, and he was shot down on his second tour, strafing an enemy airdrome. The country honored him with the Presidential Citation, the Air Medal with 7 Oak Leaf Clusters, Distinguished Flying Cross. 4 Oak Leaf Clusters, the Purple Heart. That's a very interesting story, and I want him to tell you all the details about how he was wounded and the weapon that was used. Okay, Bill? And the Silver Star with 1 cluster, and above all, the Distinguished Service Cross. Many of you did not know about this when you were listening to him on WGN. He broadcast for 20 years over 22 states on Saturday as a professional, which he'll tell you all about. He's a role model for all of us from the military standpoint and as a civilian. And it's my great honor today to introduce Mr. Bill Cullerton.
First time I've ever been too tall for a mic stand. I'll make it. My speeches aren't very well prepared, but I'll do my best to use my powers of recall to tell you a few messages that I have for you, things that I think are important to all of us. And I, at Ted's request, will tell you my personal World War II story. However, before I get into that, you know, I am used to, if I get an opportunity to talk to a group, I'm used to being the senior citizen of the group. However, I'm finding out today that at the age of 77, I better go out and have my diapers changed. Right? I'm only a kid with some of you guys here, and believe me, I'm enjoying it. I'm hearing war stories that I didn't know about. So. But it's really a pleasure, and it does bring back so many memories to see some folks, friends for over 50 years, John O'Dell. John is here. John, what a delight to see you, and what memories you bring back. John and I, on behalf of the original Cotter and Company, terrorized the saloons on Clybourne Avenue many a night. We had a lot of fun, John. It's truly a delight to see you. And seeing John and Alice Slope here, you know, I'm sitting with Alice today, and every time I look at Alice, and I've got to tell you this story because I'm sure, you heard the announcement, you know, now's the time to get out and go to the John. And I'm one of those guys that knows the name of that tune, you know. I always take care of that before I do something like this. And I remember, I don't know those of you who ever knew Carola Mandel. Carola Mandel, who you remind me of, Alice, was the wife of Colonel Leon Mandel. And some of you will remember Mandel Brothers, the old Chicagoans. Well, he was a great trap shooter and skeet shooter, and he loved the Lincoln Park Gun Club. And I remember being there one day at a shoot, and he was a gregarious guy and a lot of fun. And I was standing at the bottom of the stairs talking to Carola, and the reason you remind me, she was a dark-haired beauty, Alice, which is what you are. And I'm standing at the bottom of the stairs with Carola, and here's Leon working his way down the stairs at the Lincoln Park Gun Club. And every time he took a step, somebody would stop and say, "Oh, Leon, how are you?" And he'd talk about this, and Leon would stop and talk and chit-chat. And then he'd make another step, and somebody else would stop him. And she said to me, Dad Leon, she was from Cuba. Dad Leon, he just like my little puppy. He'd pee on every post. And that's the story that I'm reminded of. I have to tell you one other story, especially with Captain Chuck Downey here. Was going to be installed into the Military Aviation Hall of Fame, and Chuck, I for one will welcome you. It's about time we upgraded a little, and I'm glad to have you come along. And I have to tell you the experience of being a junior officer. I showed up for my installation into the Military Aviation Hall of Fame down at Chanute Field. And I showed up a little bit early, maybe an hour or so, hour and a half, before the installation ceremonies were to begin. And I was to be installed with, among other friends, General Paul Tibbets. And General Tibbets had arrived an hour ahead of me. And when I walked in, one of the fellows at the Hall of Fame said, "Bill, would you please do me a favor and go sit with the general? He's back in a room back here. And he's a little crotchety, and he's a little hard to handle, and he's bossing everybody around. Would you go sit and talk with him?" I said, "I'll be delighted." So I went back, and I introduced myself to the general, and he immediately said, "Sit down." "Yes, sir." And believe me, he was a general all the way. Get me this, get me that. And boy, I was the general's aide for the next 2 or 3 hours, and I enjoyed it. He wore 2 hearing aids. And that's another thing some of us understand is the use of that new mechanical device. He said, "Bill, the hearing aids bother the hell out of me." And he said, "We're going to be in a very big hall." And he said, "Being in this hall, if I leave the hearing aids in, if somebody drops a fork, it sounds like a bomb." He said, "So I'm going to take the hearing aids out, and here's the way we're going to do this. When I am supposed to stand up and wave at the people, you pull on my pants, and I'll stand up." And he said, "When I'm supposed to sit down, just yank on my coat a little, and I'll sit down." So that was the signals that the general worked out for myself. So we, you know how they march you in to go in. Here's a string of about 25 of us marching into the head table. The general's right up at the, he said, "Stop." And he stopped the whole damn line. He walked along the head table until he found his name and found my name. He immediately went over and picked up some guy who I didn't even, never could identify. Picked up his name, and this guy probably had arranged to sit next to the general. Took his name and put it over here. Took my name and put it right next to him and said to me, "Sit right here." "Yes, sir." So we worked during that all. But he had the hearing aids in when we sat down. And unbeknownst to him, I think it was the University of Illinois band. I'm not sure. But it was a big band. And we were in a hangar.
Oh.
And the band went kaboom. The general did. With those hearing aids go. But we had a great day, and he was a tremendous person. I truly enjoyed it, but I always remember once a general, always a general, because he had no problem at all moving me around, and I had no problem moving. I was delighted to move. Well, I want to tell you my story. And I'll tell you the story as it happened to me in 1945. And I think it brings back a tremendous amount of memories, isn't it? Especially today, I'm thinking today, April the 21st. Now, my memory could be a little wrong, but I think this is the anniversary of the death of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. At least it was within. Is it? It is. It is the anniversary. I mean, one day or another, yeah. Well, that means 60 years ago, today, at this time, I was laying in a bed in a German hospital. In Germany, the only American prisoner in the hospital, undergoing, tremendous psychological ups and downs. In the daytime, I would be in the hands of a group of Episcopalian, Lutheran or Episcopalian nuns who were as tender, a loving group of people as you could ever imagine, who were sneaking me cold cooked potatoes out of their underwear when they would come in to take care of me. And in the morning, the military would show up to interrogate me and push me down the damn stairs. So I was undergoing, you know, some mixed emotions, to say the least. And I think about that. The German staff came running in that morning. Roosevelt's dead. Hooray! Roosevelt's dead. Now, they seemed, at least to me, I think they thought that we were going to surrender, or that was the end of the war. They said, who's going to be the new president? I thought for a minute, and I said, Stalin. They didn't like that. Stalin had just beat the living hell out of them up at Stalingrad a couple of months earlier. In fact, most of the guys in the prisoners, or not prisoners, most of the German soldiers in the hospital I was in, believe it or not, I was in a town called Feustwangen, 70 to 75 miles south and west of Munich. And most of those guys, the German soldiers, had marched all the way there from Stalingrad. Their feet were frozen, their hands were frozen, they were using newspapers for bandages. It was a very tragic situation. So they had no love for me. I certainly had no love for them. But they had no love for Mr. Stalin. So anyway, Ted told you, like many other young pilots, was sent overseas the week before D-Day. The group I was with flew their first missions D-Day, day before, and several days after. In those days, it was a hell of an indoctrination. We had some of our guys didn't even get their footlockers unpacked, you know. It were terrible times for us and certainly for the enemy. But our guys were getting beat up so bad on the beaches that we were flying every daylight hour to try and to break the steel ring that the Germans had built around those beaches. As you all know, we finally did at an extremely high cost. We lost, I flew over beaches where they were literally covered with hundreds of young guys, and many of you did and know and understand the carnage that was D-Day. Fortunately, I got through the first few missions, and if you get through the first few missions, you suddenly see what's going on around you. I know the first mission I flew a guy's wing, and he said, your job is to protect my ass, son, and if you don't protect my ass, I'm going to eat yours off when we get back. And I protected his. I was glued to his wing. We got back at the end of the mission. He said, well, that was a great mission. He said, did you see that guy, that one I shot down, that 109 I shot down? I said, what 109? All I saw was the back end, the end of his wing and the end of the back end of his plane. I never saw another thing. And for most young pilots, that's the story of the first four, five, six missions until you finally realize that you are part of a well-organized, well-trained machine, and that you're going to go on to victory. We were all convinced of that. There was never a doubt in our mind that we couldn't take on the German Air Force. At that time, it was about 50-50 in the air. The invasion was certainly the signal, the long-range signal to the Germans that we were there to stay and that we were on the way. The battle for the air over Germany was a hell of a fight. And generals like Doolittle, who led the 8th Air Force, are certainly to be credited with the way they handled the fighting force early in the war. We weren't the superior force in numbers, but we were certainly the superior force in training, ability, and enthusiasm, to say the least. I got through the first tour of duty, and as any young pilot, I was 19 at that time. Those of you who flew combat at 19 and 20 know how cocky a young pilot can be, and I was just the same as all the rest of them. I was invincible. The aerial combat to me was as much fun as rabbit hunting. We couldn't wait to take those guys on every day. And we could see that we were winning the war. We could see that we were winning. I can remember one occasion, we logged the longest aerial dogfight of World War II. And though most of you who have been in aerial dogfights know that anywhere from 30 seconds to 2 or 3 minutes or 4 minutes is an extended fight. We logged a fight that went all the way across from the Baltic Sea on down to southern Germany with about 100 109s and 30 or 40 51s. And at the end of that fight, we logged a 47-minute fight, and we had destroyed 11 German aircraft, and we lost one. And that was, of all things, that was Göring's Pet Squadron. And that was a day for celebration. We lost one guy, I'll never forget. J. Dix Riggs was his name. And we regretted that, but we knew that we had taken on the best they had to offer. And we never backed down. We beat the hell out of them. And they had disappeared. They had everything, but we beat them. We were better trained. We were better prepared. And we had the enthusiasm. It was a war that we all participated in wholeheartedly with our hearts. So as I say, just as cocky as you can get, they said, "Bill, you know, you booked for a 30-day leave. So go ahead, go on home for 30 days and have some fun and get back here, and you'll be here for the closure when we can really move on." So I came home for a 30-day leave, and as luck would have it, I wasn't home 10 or 15 days. Then the Germans broke through. You all recall the Battle of the Bulge. And it was the last major move by the Germans to try and break the back of the Allied offensive. And the Germans began to break through, and my leave was interrupted. And so back I go overseas. Can't wait to get at those guys. Well, we were held on the ground for, I think from the 18th. I got back the 18th or 19th. They broke through on the 13th. Of December. 18th or 19th, we were still on the ground. And I think it was the 23rd. I could be wrong on these days, but I think it was 23rd of December that the skies over Belgium and Holland cleared. And we literally caught the German armor and their tanks, I would say 10 to 15 mile stretches of German armor and tanks all moving up to the front, all on the roads. We strafed from dawn till dusk for 5 or 6 days, and that broke the back of their advance. And I can still remember looking as far as you could see and seeing this string of smoke on these roads. And we had the entire German tank corps burning for a few days. We had some great missions in those days. The Germans were beginning to put the 262s up, the jets, and it was always quite a surprise when you're a 51 pilot, you think you got the hottest plane going. All of a sudden, they have a guy taxi right up next to you and pull away from you like you've got the anchor out. You're a little disturbed, and man, that 262 was some plane. If they ever got to where they could put more in the air than they had, they would have wrecked heaven with our bombers. It was terrible. I coasted in those days. We were having more fun digging out the German Air Force to take them on, to take them on, to try. Our mission finally became to stop them in the fields, to stop them from getting off the ground, do whatever we could to freeze them in their spot, which entailed a lot of strafing. Strafing is, believe it or not, much more dangerous than aerial combat. You know, aerial combat, when you're at 15 or 20, 25,000 feet, you really are more like one-on-one with a person. But the closer you take that plane to the ground, the more guns can reach you. And you'll come down in the 40s. First of all, the 88s can reach you, then the 40s, then the 20s, and then pretty soon you're down to where the lower caliber guns. So the closer you got to the ground, the more bullets were flying at you. And it was a case of where you couldn't defend yourself from a cannon at 90 degrees from you. So the strafing, it was costing us a lot of aircraft. And pilots, including myself, as it turned out. But we were tearing up their airdromes, and we were doing a good job of tearing them up. They, like any good anti-aircraft group, would zero certain spots on their airdrome, so that if you flew into a pattern, all they had to do was pull the trigger, and seven or eight cannons crisscross. Or slugs crisscross right at a spot you were at, and they got you. And it was in March of 45 that I was leading a squadron to the Ansbach Airdrome. Ansbach Airdrome, we had been informed, had some 262s concealed there, and we knew where they were, and it was our mission to take them out. And on the first pass across that airdrome, I can still remember it like it was yesterday. I don't know how, maybe 400 indicated, if that. It was like the plane hit a curb. Like you'd be going along in your car or something, and all of a sudden hit a curb. That's what it felt like when whatever slug hit my, probably a 40. Hit my plane, and those of you that flew know we had this huge mirror up above us so you could see anything coming up behind you, see what's going on behind you. I looked up and I saw a lick of flame, which I knew. I had probably been hitting the fuselage tank, which was an 85-gallon tank parked right behind the pilot. We were protected by an armor plate, but I knew I had been hit, and my altitude at the time I was hit probably was anywhere from 10 to 30 feet. I racked back on the stick, took it as long as I felt I could, not to the apex of the climb, but I took it up high enough so that I thought I could bail. I knew I had to get out of that plane. And for those of you who might say, gee, how do you get out of the plane? Believe me, it's no problem. Well, you want to get out of that, baby, and you know it's on fire. Hell, I've had guys say, well, did you have an ejection seat? I said, yep, me. Not the ejection seat. How did you get the cowling off? I don't remember. Maybe I went through it. All I know is I was getting the hell out of that plane, and I got out of that plane. You remember little things. I remember getting out of the plane and tumbling a little bit. And in those days, as everybody did, I smoked. And I can still remember seeing a package of Old Golds right out in front of me. God, there goes my cigarettes. The chute chute no sooner popped than I hit the ground. It was that close. The chute popped, and I hit the ground. The plane wasn't 500 feet from me, and it was a flaming pile. I think for a minute or two, they thought I was in the plane. The fellows that I flew with all reported me killed in a crash. None of them saw the ship. This is when you're, so-called escape and evasion tactics. You're supposed to be so finely tuned, and you're so sharp and so quick. You know exactly what you're going to do. I jumped up and I ran, boy. And I ran. And it was getting tougher to run because I was pulling the chute. Stopped. Think about this a minute now. I unhooked the chute, and I was in a strip, a farm strip, and I did remember I took the chute to one side of the strip, wrapped it under a little pine tree, and then began my evasion over on the other strip across the way. I could hear the sirens of trucks coming out to the scene of the wreck, and I could hear the air raid sirens and the shootings finally quieted down, and the trucks showed up with they had seen my chute pop, and they were out to find me. So for the next two or three days, the German Army and I played cat and dog. I did have some training in the woods as a youngster. My grandfather was a camper and a fisherman and a hunter, and I had spent many nights in the woods with my grandfather. And I attribute those nights that I spent with him to helping me evade. They developed a rather unique tactic. I don't know if you've ever seen these giant schnauzers, a big 150-pound, unappetizing-looking animal. And they would release one of those guys every once in a while, and when I shot them, they would hear the gunshot, and they'd change the direction of the hunt. However, after about the third or fourth night, they gave up. They stopped looking for me, and I was on my own. Again, this training, and Captain Downey, I see you smiling every time I talk about the training that we all have. And so at night, I figured the best time to move is at night. But I wanted to be sure that I had the right compass heading all the time. At least I was that well trained that you go in one direction. And we had these little buttons. You unscrewed the button, and it was a compass. There was a really finely machined little compass. And I'd unscrew this button on my flying suit, look at my compass at twilight, and then take off in that direction. And I'd go for 3-4 hours, and then I had to check my directions, so I would stop and unscrew my compass. And I carried a little packet of matches that I carried as a Boy Scout, believe it or not, in a little steel container. I don't know how, but I carried these store matches. And I had about 10 of those babies, so I would strike a match and look at my compass and get the direction, take off. Well, over two or three nights, I wasted maybe 3 or 4 matches. Till one night I unscrewed the compass, and I looked at it, and the damn thing was luminous. Or I was wasting all those matches. So, again, the training, the things you try and think of. We had, we carried in a little kit, I think they were called halazone tablets, is that right? Halazone, any medical guys might correct me on that, but it was a tablet that you put in water when you wanted to drink some water. Well, I had that with me in a week, and I was drinking water out of mud puddles, and before I remembered, I had the hell I drank. I as far as I know, I was drinking horse pee. You know, it didn't bother me. It tasted pretty good. I was thirsty and hungry. But